The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We're basically seeing a shakedown in the kingdom, all of which raises the question, what happens after the king? King Solomon is in his early 80s. Based on his brothers, he could go on living for another 10 years or so. He suffers from pre-dementia, but it doesn't prohibit him or prevent him from carrying out his tasks. If he wishes to, he can stay in office for some time, but he may not. There are all kinds of rumors about abdication possibilities. And I think when you put all of this together, you also have to say there is a possibility, not a probability, but a possibility of the perfect storm in the kingdom of Saudi Arabia coming soon. The combination of serious economic problems, of a foreign policy in defeat, and of a succession process which is trying to do something they've avoided doing for 75 years.
I'm Vanessa Sauter, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 5th, 2017. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, America's longtime ally in the Middle East, faces a tumultuous future, plummeting oil prices, an ongoing royal purge, and Yemen's civil war across the border have thrust the kingdom into a domestic and international maelstrom. But what role do the United States play in Saudi Arabia's changing position? To address that question, Bruce Rydell, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, recently discussed his new book, Kings and Presidents, Saudi Arabia and America Since FDR, at a Brookings event. Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council, moderated the conversation, in which they discussed the state of U.S.-Saudi relations, the historical events that have precipitated Saudi Arabia's current situation, and the future of the kingdom. It's a Lawfare Podcast, episode 266, Bruce Rydell on Kings and Presidents.
This relationship is about to turn 75. The U.S.-Saudi relationship dates from 1943, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt invited the King of Saudi Arabia, King Abdulaziz Al Saud, better known as Ibn Saud, to send a delegation to wartime Washington. The King sent two princes, Prince Faisal and Prince Khalid, who would both go on to be kings in their own right. They stayed at Blair House. They were dined, but not wined, in the White House. They met with the president in the Oval Office. They met with Congress. They then traveled across the country from Washington to Texas, naturally, and California, and then back to Princeton in the Northeast, all because Franklin Delano Roosevelt wanted to convince the Saudis of the strength and vitality of the United States of America, and in effect have the sons come back and tell the daddy, you can rely on the Americans after the war. They are going to be the most powerful people in the world. It was a remarkable insight into FDR's concept of what the post-war era would be like. It's hard to imagine very many Americans in 1943 seeing ahead with the clarity that Roosevelt did. In those 75 years, this relationship has had some remarkable highs and some very, very deep lows. The highs included the liberation of Kuwait in 1991, the defeat of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan in 1989. The Oslo peace process, to a certain extent, was one of the highs. But it's had very deep lows. 9/11 being the one that people most remember. And it wasn't just about what happened in New York and Washington that day. 9/11 crystallized a growing problem between the United States and Saudi Arabia in 2001. In the book, I refer to these lows as near-death experiences, because this relationship has, over the course of those 75 years, come very close to rupturing completely on more than one occasion. The most famous occasion, of course, being the 1973 oil embargo. Saudi Arabia, in supporting the oil embargo, in leading the oil embargo in 1973, inflicted more economic damage on average Americans than any foreign power ever has before or since. It's not something we advertise when we talk about the relationship, but it's important. For me, I've spent over 40 years as a professional Saudi watcher by one employer or another. For 90% of that time, it was predictable, it was stable, frankly, it was boring. You knew exactly what was going to happen. You could state definitively Saudi policy will be X, and you knew it would be X. In the last 3 years, that's not true anymore. Saudi Arabia has become incredibly volatile and unpredictable. It is now filled with rumors like we have never seen before. The royal family has always been opaque. It has now become far more than opaque. Saudiology today, I would argue, is more difficult than Kremlinology at the height of the Cold War. Today, the relationship, superficially, is closer than ever. President Donald Trump made Saudi Arabia his first foreign port of call. And the relationship during that visit was extraordinary. The Saudis flattered Mr. Trump in every way possible, and he returned the flattery. And since then, he has given them, in effect, a blank check for their foreign policy and for their internal politics. He has completely endorsed the young Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in all of his endeavors, including the recent purge of the royal family. But on closer examination, the relationship today is in fact deeply troubled. If the executive branch has a very close relationship with Saudi Arabia, that's not true for the two other branches of our government. The judiciary in the United States is now putting Saudi Arabia on trial. Saudi Arabia is facing several court cases in New York under the Justice Against Supporters of Terrorism Act, JASTA, which was passed over Obama's veto, the only time one of his vetoes was passed over by the Senate last year in a vote 98-0. The two senators who didn't vote against it, who abstained, were Tim Kaine and Bernie Sanders, who were both on the campaign trail and who both said they would have voted for it as well. So in other words, the Senate would have voted 100-0 to make Saudi Arabia held legally liable for its alleged involvement in the September 11th plot. The fact that the Hill did that shows you something else. The legislative branch of our government is no longer that enthusiastic about this relationship. The last arms sales that went forward to the Hill passed with a margin of only 2 votes. And the administration hasn't sent another arms sales up to the Senate since then. If the relationship is more troubled than it appears superficially, Saudi Arabia is definitely more troubled than it may appear superficially. Let me briefly look at 3 aspects of this. First, the economy. King Salman ascended to the throne after oil prices had bottomed out. Saudi Arabia needs oil prices to be in the range of $80 to $85 a barrel in order to sustain its cradle-to-grave social security system for its people. $50 a barrel means they can't do that. It's unsustainable. In the 3 years since he ascended to the throne, 1/3 of Saudi Arabia's reserves have already been spent. You don't need to have an MBA from the Wharton School to figure out what that means 6 years from now. The good news for the Saudis is at least they recognize they have a problem. They should. Growth in the kingdom flatlined last year, and they went into recession a few months ago. They understand that they need to do something about it. And King Salman and the Crown Prince have come up with a very ambitious, very thoughtful, and very innovative program, Saudi Vision 2030. there are some very innovative ideas in Saudi Vision 2030, not the least of which is allowing women to drive, which means that 500,000 chauffeurs can be given the boot and sent home, assuming that women actually in the end do drive. That will help the Saudi economy considerably. There are other good ideas in it. But the core ideas to reduce public sector spending and to reduce subsidies have already been reversed. They tried reducing subsidies. They tried reducing salaries for public servants. It didn't work. There was a national outcry. They've reversed them and in some cases made them worse. So while Saudi Vision 2030 has a lot of good ideas, its practical implementation so far has been hesitant at best and a failure at worst. Secondly, is the question of their national security policy. And here the influence of the young crown prince is clearer than anywhere else. A foreign policy that had long been cautious and risk-averse and relied upon the checkbook, not upon diplomacy or military intervention, has turned around in the opposite direction. Saudi foreign policy has become adventurous, interventionist, if not reckless in the extreme. The war in Yemen, which is Mohammed bin Salman's signature policy move, has turned into a quagmire. It was supposed to be Operation Decisive Storm. There's nothing decisive about it except the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world today. Save the Children has recently estimated that if the blockade continues as it has been for the last couple of weeks since the missile was fired at Riyadh Airport, 50,000 children could die in Yemen before the end of this year. 50,000 before the end of this year. If that doesn't happen, it still means a catastrophe, a man-made catastrophe of enormous extent. 7 million Yemenis are on the edge of starvation, dependent entirely upon what the UN and other international programs can get them. Saudi defense spending in Yemen is, of course, a well-kept secret. The lowest estimate that I found is $700 million a month. In a kingdom that doesn't have the money, that's an enormous expense of money. It's reflective of the fact that Saudi Arabia has one of the highest defense budgets in the world. In 2015, it had the third largest defense budget in the world, behind the United States and China. On a per capita basis, it came to almost $7,000 per person. Even Americans don't spend $7,000 per person on the United States military. It's unsustainable as well. The blockade of Qatar, announced 6 months ago, has so far been a failure. Worse is coming in this area, much worse than we've seen so far. I think the beginnings of what will be a very divisive conflict in the Gulf is in front of us. The GCC is, to all intents and purposes, dead today. Lebanon may be next. Lebanese I talk to fear that they are going to become roadkill in the confrontation between Saudi Arabia and Iran. All of these policies reflect the fact that Saudi Arabia, under King Salman and his son, has become much more risk-prone in dealing with Iran. It has broken relations with the Iranians. It has adopted a foreign policy that is much more sectarian than anything we have seen since the end of the second Saudi kingdom in the late 19th century. Which brings us lastly to internal politics. Mohammed bin Salman has moved from defense minister to crown prince in 30 months. Or to be more accurate, his father has moved him from defense minister to crown prince in 30 months. Mohammed bin Salman is obviously a very ambitious person, and he's been very effective in moving forward. But in the Saudi system, if your father is the king, it really isn't that hard to do this. And he's proven it's not hard to do that. Two sitting crown princes have been removed from their position, unprecedented in Saudi history. The second one, Mohammed bin Nayef, was removed in a remarkable way, literally in the middle of the night, and to a certain extent, almost at gunpoint, and kept incommunicado ever since then. Mohammed bin Nayef was the closest thing Saudi Arabia had to a genuine hero in this century, and he deserved it. He was one of the preeminent counter-terrorists in the world today and was willing to take great personal risk, much more than his counterparts in most security services. He was smeared after being removed as a drug addict. The reason he might have been, if he is a drug addict, is because of the wounds he sustained in an al-Qaeda assassination plot. The removal of Mohammed bin Nayef has now been followed by the purge of the royal family and the establishment, an unprecedented event in Saudi politics as well. Saudi politics in the past was, of course, an absolute monarchy, married to a theocracy, with the instruments of a police state. But there were rules and decorum about how royals treated other royals. You could be the worst governor in the history of the Saudi system and be removed, but you got a golden parachute. You were not humiliated in public. You were given the chance to move on to a new job with your dignity and honor and integrity kept intact. Those rules are gone now. Saudi Arabia, some of my Saudi friends say, now looks more like a mafiosa state than it did the state that they learned they lived up in. If the New York Times article today about how the people purged are being extorted to turn over their own finances to the crown prince is true, we're basically seeing a shakedown in the kingdom. All of which raises the question, what happens after the king? King Salman is in his early 80s. Based on his brothers, he could go on living for another 10 years or so. He suffers from pre-dementia, but it doesn't prohibit him or prevent him from carrying out his tasks. If he wishes to, he can stay in office for some time, but he may not. There are all kinds of rumors about abdication possibilities. And I think when you put all of this together, you also have to say there is a possibility, not a probability, but a possibility of the perfect storm in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia coming soon. The combination of serious economic problems, of a foreign policy in defeat, and of a succession process which is trying to do something they've avoided doing for 75 years, which is passing not from a son of Ibn Saud, but to a grandson of Ibn Saud. These things could come together. So watch this space. As I said at the beginning, Saudi Arabia is no longer boring. It's certainly exciting, and it's certainly unpredictable. And thank you for coming today.
I think I'll start with something that's swirling around very much in the news now. One of the things that you write about that used to be sort of rock solid was that the House of Saud could never recognize the state of Israel without a real Palestinian peace plan, a real Palestinian state. Now we hear that there is some peace plan which is being cooked up between Jared Kushner and Mohammed bin Salman. Very few people have seen it, but there seems to be certainly among some who are supporters of Bibi Netanyahu and his government in Israel, this idea that at long last Saudi Arabia will really be side by side with Israel against Iran, against Hezbollah, and in return the Israelis will have to perhaps have some sort of cosmetic peace plan. Is this something that could actually happen now, and is it a sustainable idea?
Okay. Let me start with a little bit of history before I jump in there. Saudi-Israeli covert cooperation is not new to the 21st century. In the 1960s, the Mossad and the Saudi intelligence agency cooperated together in supporting a insurgency in Yemen. Remember, we're now against an insurgency in Yemen, but in the 1960s, they supported together, in coordination with each other, an insurgency in Yemen. The British played the critical role of the middleman, but the two intelligence services knew what the other one were doing, and the Israelis, for example, paradropped equipment to the insurgents in Yemen, the royalists at the time, flying down the Red Sea
with the full knowledge of the Royal Saudi Air Force. So covert cooperation is not new between Saudis and Israelis. King Faisal, probably the most pro-Palestinian Saudi king of our lifetimes, was willing to engage in it. Are they willing now to go beyond the realm of covert operation to an overt operation? I remain skeptical. I'll be frank. I'm skeptical. You said that very few people have seen the peace plan between Jared and others. I think included in that number is Jared. I don't think there is much of a peace plan here. I think there's talk about a peace plan. I think it's a very useful cover for travel to the region to say you're talking about a peace plan. Will the Saudis be prepared to overtly recognize Israel, send an embassy to Tel Aviv, presumably not Jerusalem? I remain a skeptic. I think that there are deeply entrenched parts of the Saudi system, particularly the clerical establishment, that would find that very, very hard to stomach. But I'll repeat myself once again. We're in a whole new world. Yeah. Anything could happen at this point. So I wouldn't say it's impossible, but I remain skeptical.
Okay. Well, that leads very naturally into the next question, which is that another thing that MBS is doing is talking about introducing or reintroducing a quote-unquote moderate Islam to the kingdom. He has stopped the religious police from roaming around and harassing people in the way that they used to do. Women are supposedly going to be allowed to drive next year and so on. There is entertainment for young Saudis. I spoke to a woman the other day who had gone to a stadium for the first time in her life in Saudi Arabia and was really still excited about that ability. So the question is it possible for the Saudis to somehow change the sort of Islam that's practiced inside and the sort of Islam that they have been propagating outside since King Faisal, or is this also kind of smoke and mirrors? What do you think?
Parts of Saudi Vision 2030, which did not use the word at the time moderate Islam, certainly open up the door to social changes which are significantly different from the way Islam has been practiced in the country. You mentioned entertainment, women driving. I want to give the crown prince and the king credit for that, particularly the king. The king built the most Wahhabi city in the world, Riyadh, from scratch. When he became governor of Riyadh, there was less than 200,000 people. Now it has over 7 million people. But he did it to create the most Wahhabi city in the world. So the king is clearly willing to consider some options they haven't in the past. Now, a cynic will say that because they're failing to deliver on the economic part, the hard part, they're going for the easy part, which is opening up some of these societal norms. But that's too cynical. These easy parts are not easy at all. There are powerful opposition to it. And Saudi youth are not all Bernie Sanders supporters walking around in thobes. The top 10 Twitter accounts in Saudi Arabia all belong to very conservative Islamic clerics, not from the opposition, but from the mainstream Wahhabi clerical establishment. But at the same time, parts of the old Wahhabi creed are now on fumes. I mean, this is the most sectarian Saudi government we have seen since Ibn Saud. Not just abroad, but at home. Parts of the eastern province have been in open rebellion now and are being plowed under and literally turned into concrete wastelands as the Saudis try to eliminate Shia opposition, violent Shia opposition, which they blame on Iran, of course, but much of which is indigenous and has been there for a long time. So it's a mix. There's parts of the Wahhabi creed which are now being pushed very, very hard, and parts which are being, and I think this reflects a young man who is feeling his way.
Yeah. you know, I mentioned that King Faisal, and this was good to remind myself because I know that the Saudi foreign minister has been going around saying that Islamic fundamentalism and so on, it's all the fault of Iran in the 1979 revolution. It was useful to recall that it was King Faisal who began the propagation of Wahhabi Islam, building mosques, sending clerics out throughout the Muslim world. Back in the 60s, the Muslim World League was created then, the Organization of Islamic Conference was created then. So what happens out in the Muslim world with these kinds of purported changes in Saudi Arabia, the custodian of the two holy mosques? I mean, is this going to be accepted in the broader Muslim world? And could there be a backlash that would affect Saudi interests that could be dangerous for Saudi Arabia in terms of generating increased support for Al-Qaeda or ISIS or other militant groups?
I'll give you a concrete example to work from. The largest mosque in the European Union is in Brussels. I describe it in the book. It's in the heart of the city on one of its biggest parks. I lived across the street from it for 3.5 years. It has been a center of Saudi Wahhabi ideological training since it became a mosque in the 1970s. Recently, the Belgian government, for understandable reasons, has been trying to persuade the Saudis to let the government of Belgium have some influence over what is preached in that mosque. And the Saudis are resisting it tooth and nail. They will not let that mosque be changed. And it's become something of a cause célèbre in Belgium today. So there's a concrete example of where whatever the foreign minister may say, and whatever they may be talking about moderate Islam, it's not turning into action on the ground, and it's being resisted. The other thing I would say is King Abdullah, in his time as king, often talked about finding a more tolerant version of Islam, and he promoted inter-church dialogue, including inviting Shintus as well as, almost every religion was invited to events that the Saudis paid for. There were two notable things about these events. One, they never happened in Saudi Arabia. They always happened in Vienna or Barcelona or someplace like that. And two, Shias were hardly ever invited to these events. So let's see. Let's see whether there's really something to all of this. I think it's too early to say.
In terms of potential threats to Saudi Arabia, though, I mean, they managed to defeat Al-Qaeda a decade ago. But this kind of policy could clearly create, one would think, a lot of enemies within the state and outside. And you mentioned Mohammed bin Nayef, who was an extremely effective counterterrorism chief. Are you worried about the capability of the kingdom to continue in terms of counterterrorism with Mohammed bin Nayef under, in effect, house arrest? And I'm not sure who took his place, but...
I'm very worried. The short answer is I'm very worried. Mohammed bin Nayef brought to the Ministry of Interior, which is one of the largest bureaucracies in Saudi Arabia. There are claims that as many as 1 million Saudis get a paycheck one way or another from the Ministry of Interior. That would be 1 out of 20 people. I'm not sure that's true, but it gives you a sense of how big this is. He was the dynamic force that made the MOI the successful counterterrorism element it was. What I understand in the few months since he's gone, there's been a measurable drop in efficiency. The MOI was the stronghold of the Nayef wing of the family, just as the Saudi Arabian National Guard was the stronghold of the Abdullah wing. With that wing gone, it's not just him, it's the system. His replacement has no experience in this business at all. There is a price to be made in removing people like this, and the price will end up being in the practical world of fighting terrorists. That said, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State in Saudi Arabia are not, they're a terrorist nuisance. They're not potential heirs in the event that the Saudi royal family, for some reason or other, split apart.
I want to ask you a couple sort of broad questions about the relationship in general. I mean, it was essentially trading security for oil for all of these years. The United States doesn't need Saudi oil anymore. Other countries obviously do, and the United States obviously takes its role as a protector in the Persian Gulf very, very seriously. But looking forward, you know, is that going to remain the case if Saudi Arabia remains undemocratic? And although the king is the crown prince is pushing a lot of reforms, he's certainly not broadening the political system in any way. If the world's dependence on oil continues to diminish, what's the trajectory of this relationship? And is it wise for the United States to put so many eggs in Riyadh's basket?
I make the case in the book that more near-death experiences are more likely than not, that there are at least three issues that are going to be troublesome to the relationship. One is the continuation of the Palestinian question. Mm-hmm. Palestinian question is in remission right now. If another intifada begins or something, Palestinian question can come back onto the front burner very, very, very quickly. And in that case, Saudi Arabia's long-term commitment to it will make for challenges in the relationship. Secondly, there's the whole Wahhabi question, which we've talked about. I think there's a third factor, which is newer, and you were precisely getting to it, Barbara, which is Saudi Arabia is, in effect, the leader of the counter-revolution. If the Arab Spring was led on the street, the counter-revolution has been led by the royal palace in Saudi Arabia, and quite actively. The first time we saw Saudi troops intervene in another country was Bahrain in 2011. And King Abdullah at that time gave President Obama the Riot Act. He said, if you don't accept this, the relationship is over. Forget it. And President Obama backed down. Both Secretary Clinton and Secretary Gates write about it in their autobiographies. The Trump administration has not made the promotion of democracy and human rights a centerpiece of its foreign policy. That's very out of character with American foreign policy under both Republicans and Democrats. Maybe it's the wave of the future. I'm skeptical. And I think that as the counter-revolution tries to hold back change, the political wing of change in the Arab world, there are going to be more times when the United States and Saudi Arabia are going to find each other on opposite sides. Maybe not over what happens in the kingdom, but over what may be happening in other parts of the Arab world. We'll see. So I think there are at least three reasons to believe that this relationship is going to be even rockier in the future than it has been up until now. Now, you're right, we don't need Saudi oil. The Japanese, the Chinese, the Indians do. We have an interest in a stable energy market. So as part of a global world order, we have an interest in all of that. But here again, the Trump administration is taking a very different discourse than the United States has up until today and become more unpredictable. There's also one other factor I can say from experience. Long past the point where alliances don't make sense anymore, the United States tends to hold on to them. And it'll be the Saudi relationship will be on autopilot for some period after it no longer really makes sense to be the first country for a president of the United States to go visit.
Given that my particular interests involve Iran as much as they do the other side of the Persian Gulf, I can't resist and ask you about both the current U.S. policy toward Iran and the Saudi policy toward Iran, which seem to be very, very similar these days. There was a time when the United States was trying to promote conflict resolution.
Right.
We famously remember President Obama suggesting that the Saudis and the Iranians should share the Persian Gulf. Now the Saudi policy has gone so far to the other extreme that they seem to be quite willing to risk the stability of Lebanon, in addition to all the other areas in the region, in order to somehow retaliate against Iran, retaliate against Hezbollah. I just would be curious for your reflections on these policies and whether there is any way they can be recalibrated in Washington. I mean, we sense some hesitancy on the part of the Pentagon, State Department, but it does seem as though this is really not kings and presidents, but crown prince and president's son-in-law determining our policy in the region right now.
Let me deal with Saudi Iran and then sons and son-in-laws. Part of the reason Saudi foreign policy looks so different today is because in terms of the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran, the Iranians are cleaning the Saudi clock. They're winning everywhere, and it's not even close in most places. Look at Syria. The Saudis spent a fortune, even by Saudi standards, on arming the Sunni revolutionaries. It's a case of where they did support revolution, not because they like the idea of a democracy in Syria, obviously, but because they wanted to support the Sunnis against the Alawis and their Iranian Shia friends and Hezbollah. They've lost. It's over. Syrian civil war may go on for a long time, but the groups the Saudis supported have more or less faded off of the battlefield. Iraq. With the tremendous assistance of the United States of America, and particularly President George W. Bush, we have now reversed 500 years of Sunni domination of Iraq and put the Shias in charge. Now, one of the more innovative policies Mohammed bin Salman pursued this year was to get back in the Iraq game, mm-hmm. to send an ambassador to receive a prominent Shias in Saudi Arabia. And then the Kurds messed it all up. And the Iranians are stronger now in Iraq than they were 6 months ago. And Saudi Arabia's effort to reach out hasn't had any real tangible benefits. I hope they're not ready to give up there. But in Syria and Iraq, in the competition between Riyadh and Tehran, there's not much competition left. The Saudis have lost, and they know it. They're not stupid. And Syria and Iraq are a lot more important for Saudi Arabia than Lebanon, and I would argue even Yemen. So let's turn to Yemen. Saudi Arabia is spending conservatively, let's say $700 million a month. I have no idea how much money Iran and Hezbollah is spending, but I doubt it's $7 million a month. Iran is prepared to fight to the last Lebanese and Yemeni, and Hezbollah is prepared to fight to the last Yemeni. In return for creating a quagmire that's expensive, Saudi Arabia has given Iran a way of sticking it to them in their soft underbelly. And now, for very little expense, Iran has figured out a way to fire rockets at Riyadh. And by the way, Abu Dhabi is next. And what are the Saudis going to do about it? Well, this time they declared war on Lebanon. That made a lot of sense. They're not going to disarm the Hezbollah. The Lebanese army is not going to disarm Hezbollah. Hariri is not going to disarm Hezbollah. And as long as Hezbollah is armed to the teeth, it will be the dominant political force in Lebanon. It's hard to understand what the purpose of this little escapade with Hariri is all about. My Lebanese friends, who I admit don't know, and some of them admit they don't know too, all tell me it's a shakedown. Mr. Hariri's being shook down for his money. I don't know. That might be the case. It's a pretty vicious game, if that's the game. And if any of you here are thinking about investing in the kingdom, I would urge you to get to the bottom of the facts about this, because if it can happen to Mr. Hariri, it can certainly happen to an American company investing in Saudi Arabia.
Well, that leads to my last question before I open up, and that is, so much of Vision 2030 depends on investment. It depends on Saudi investment. It depends on foreign investment. How, with all of the chaos that is going on now in the kingdom, can any foreign company be expected to invest in Vision 2030?
Very good question. And
what happens to the Aramco IPO that we've heard so much about?
From my very unscientific sample of people who call me from oil companies and other people who do invest in Saudi Arabia, there's a palpable sense of despair since the so-called purge began, that they don't know what's going to happen. They don't see the rule of law applying here. And Saudi apologists who say that we had to do it in this dramatic way because it was the only way to shake up the system, that doesn't make very many lawyers feel very comfortable about telling their client, oh yeah, don't worry, you can invest in Saudi Arabia. So I think it's self-defeating in that sense. If the real cynics, and the New York Times published it today, are right, then the Crown Prince and the King have already gone beyond looking for outside financial. They're just going to steal the money of the 200 people or so who are now enjoying the life of leisure in the Ritz. I don't know whether that's true, and I think that would be a very dangerous policy for Saudi Arabia to pursue.
But in fairness, a lot of that money was, in a sense, stolen from the people of Saudi Arabia over the years by princes and others just simply taking what they wanted from oil revenues, right? So,
true.
But
and who exactly doesn't fall into that category in the royal family? I've never bought a $500 million yacht on the spur of the moment, but I don't think that comes out of your government stipend when you're able to do that. And I'm not singling out anyone here, but the policies are likely to be counterproductive. And the IPO, which is a good idea, which is a very good idea, is fraught with all kinds of problems,
sure.
Not the least of which is JASTA. If you open the IPO on the New York Stock Exchange, watch the rush of lawyers who are going to immediately ask for a judge to have that held until the outcome of the 9/11 trials is produced. And I'll just say one last thing about the 9/11 trials. Don't expect that these trials are going to absolve Saudi Arabia. I'm not saying Saudi Arabia was involved in the plot. We can talk about that if you want. But don't expect the U.S. litigation process to absolve the kingdom of any responsibility for 9/11. I'd be very, very surprised if the American judiciary come up with that conclusion.
I want to thank you, Bruce, and thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you.
It's good.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tweet the Lawfare Podcast, share it on Facebook, create a subreddit to talk about your favorite episodes, and give it a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution system you may use. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.